The following program was pre-recorded. On WFAN, it's time for Hello, My Name is Craig, our weekly candid conversation about gambling addiction. It's supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER. Now, here's Craig Carton.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Hello, My Name is Craig. Craig Carton, right there for the next 30 minutes of frank, open, honest conversation about gambling addiction and compulsive gamblers like myself. Joining me as always is my main man, Mr. Danny Trillaro. Dan, good morning. How are you?
I'm well, Craig. I'm well. Getting ready to head back out on the road at the Temple next week. So it's good to be home for the weekend.
Nice little Philadelphia. All good. And happy to have from Brooklyn, Paul joining us today. Paul's been in recovery, wow, 41 years. My man, pots and pans. When was your last wager, Paul?
It was in September of 1983.
Wow. Well, God bless you on that. I'm sure you're very proud of it and wear it with great respect. So I appreciate you coming on here today. Let's tell your story a little bit. How old were you when you first got exposed to any type of gambling, well before it became a problem for you?
Well, I made my first bet in November of 1957, a 25-cent bet on a football game.
I assume it was on the Giants?
No, it was a college game.
Okay.
It was a Notre Dame game.
Okay, so that was the start of it. And how old were you when that bet took place?
I was 11.
Wow. So was it an older brother, a dad, an uncle, a neighborhood friend who exposed you to
I was actually working in a small Italian grocery store in Bensonhurst.
Okay.
That was really a gambling establishment. So I would be there, and when people would come in to play cards, I would write down against the wall what time they came in. And then when they left, I would have to pick up the hourly wages or the hourly rates.
Wow. So you were exposed to it at a young age, almost like a Bronx Tale type of story, yeah?
Absolutely, positively.
Got it. So was there, when you look back on your life with the clarity you have now, was there a part of it, and if I reference Bronx Tale, where you were in awe of the adults that you saw and how they were living their lives, that type of story?
I certainly was. The majority of the people that frequented the place were Italian-speaking, and I spoke perfect Italian, having just immigrated to the country. And I was exposed to something that didn't exist in my life. And I saw money. I never had a nickel to my name, and I was absolutely flabbergasted by what I witnessed.
How quickly did it become an everyday event for you? And I don't mean hanging out with the guys or in a social club or a bar. How quickly did you start gambling regularly?
The day after. And it continued that way for 26 years on a daily basis.
Dan, let me bring you in here. We talk a lot about, being a young person, man or woman, and being exposed to gambling and it being, frankly, really cool.
Mm-hmm. And this is an example where, 11 years old, hanging out, and it's culturally accepted, right? It's in the family, and it's just like, you're just in awe. And hearing this story is just, this one just lands a little bit differently because it's so in your face and you had a role to play within it. So you're not only just watching it, but you're involved in the process. And so you're getting entrenched and involved in the world. And you're like, wow, this is cool. I'm hanging out with cool people. I'm seeing cool things. I'm starting to learn the language, how things work. And yeah, it's really easy for a young person, especially 11 years old, very impressionable, to say, yeah, I can do this and I can really enjoy this a lot. And then it's reinforced on a daily basis.
Paul, I wonder for you, one of the things I get mad at myself about is that, I've been gambling since I'm 8 years old. I owned an offshore casino in Costa Rica. I started one of the most trafficked, sports handicapping websites in the history of the internet. So, and I say that not to brag about it because it's not worth bragging about. But I saw people lose everything. I saw people on full tilt. I saw people chasing losses, et cetera, et cetera. And yet I went down that road anyway. And I would think your life experience has to be similar in that from a young age. You saw the negative side of gambling as much as you saw anything positive, right?
Absolutely. And the truth of the matter is, that for the next 26 years of gambling on a daily basis, the only thing that I wanted was to win back that original 25 cents. And I wanted to go back to what life was like prior to making the first bet. It had nothing to do with winning. I just wanted to go back. Needless to say, can't do it. So you can't unscramble a scrambled egg.
For a quarter of a century, you were chasing losses just to get even, not to do anything beyond that. That's fascinating.
I never had dreams of grandeur to buy a house in Sorrento. I didn't have any of those dreams. I just wanted to go back to be who I was prior to making the first bet.
So at the height of your gambling, when you become a young adult or into your 20s now, give me an idea of just how bad it was, how often you gambled, how much time you spent on gambling, you know, at the real height of it.
Well, I gambled every day. I gambled every hour. Gambling was part of my, I can't say DNA because I come from a family that certainly did not gamble, but it was just part of my body. I could not go a day without making a bet. And I've always stated that the only thing worse than making a bet was when time was there that I could not make a bet.
And I would think your behavior was completely opposite of the work ethic and the thought process of your dad and your relatives, right?
Well, I'll tell you what I say all the time, that I was not, when my parents got together in 1945 to create a human being, that human being being me, never did they expect that they had created the monster that gambling made me.
Let's talk about, if you don't mind, the bad stuff before we get to how you changed and turned your life around.
Yeah.
I imagine, you know, 1950s, Bensonhurst, you know, knowing a lot about the city. My dad, you know, born in 1937, you know, lived in Brooklyn as well. So I have a pretty good understanding of the history of that part of the borough. You're meeting bad people. You're borrowing money from bad people. There had to be a moment where you were in trouble, I imagine, right? Or not one moment, probably lots of moments where you were in trouble.
I was in trouble every day for those 26 years. Every day I was looking for a bookmaker, and every day I was looking for a loan shark, and every day I was thinking of what criminal acts I could commit so that I could continue to gamble.
Did you ever?
The action was overpowering.
So there had to be a point in your life, I assume, where you got jammed up by the police and by the city and state, yeah?
Well, that came much later on. But during those years, until I came into the program, I was never, I ended up in prison, but I ended up in prison much later. That's another story in itself. But during the years that I was gambling, I actually held a teaching job for a lot of years. And the teaching job allowed me the freedom to continue to gamble.
And gambling was more important than, you know, breathing oxygen, I assume.
Absolutely, positively. Yeah. It was the anxiety of making that bet. It was the excitement of the bet. And as always, it ended up with depression because I knew that I was going to lose.
Dan, have they figured out yet what goes on inside our brains that make the winning and losing less important than the playing?
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that I knew that I was going to lose. That doesn't mean that I gambled to lose, but I knew I was going to lose. But it was just the excitement of the bet that was more overwhelming than anything I've ever had in my life.
Yeah, that's the brain science behind it. It's not just the winning and losing that counts. It's the participation, like actually doing it. It's the anticipation, thinking about it. Craig, I'm thinking about something that you say a lot, the amount of mental free space that we get back from being in recovery and actually just hearing the story, looking every day for bookmakers, for Shylocks, for how to get bets in, you know, whatever it is. That's so much time that we're consumed with that in recovery we get that space back. But initially, life's not as exciting. I mean, the whole process is exciting every day. You know, will I find what I need? How will it go down? All of the uncertainty. You know, uncertainty is exciting. And to people who get comfortable being uncomfortable, we almost crave it and we thrive on it.
Paul, I'm sure we could talk to you for hours and hours to hear some of your stories. And I'd love the opportunity to do that with you one day. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. you know, the show's only 30 minutes, so I'm wondering if you don't mind sharing, what was the bottom of the barrel moment for you? What was the lowest of lows that made you wake up one day and say, I'm not doing this anymore? What happened?
Well, one thing happened that there was one of those no mas moments. Mm-hmm. I had just lost a teaching job because of my gambling, because I was stealing from the school. I was borrowing from students. I was borrowing from teachers. I was doing a lot of shenanigans, and I ended up working in a grocery store, and I had to deliver a prosciutto and mozzarella sandwich with a 7-Up to the lady across the street from this deli, and she gave me a 10-cent tip. And as I walked across 18th Avenue back to that deli, I broke down in the middle of the avenue, threw my hands up in the air and said, is this what life is all about? Is this the stage that I'm at? I wanted to tell her what to do with the 10 cents. Of course, I didn't. But that was the day that I said, this has to be something else. I cannot continue the life that I'm living.
So the humiliation of getting a 10-cent tip is what ultimately led you to go get help?
Yes.
That's fascinating. It's so powerful.
Well, that's one of... And then the other thing was that I ran out of bookmakers and I ran out of loan sharks.
Right, right.
And my wife had just found out that the man that she was married to was really not the man that she was married to, because for the first time in over 15 years or so, that the mail was delivered to the house rather than somewhere else. And that's when she realized that I was living a world unbeknown to her.
Take a quick break. Paul is with us from Brooklyn, and of course, Dan Trillaro. This is Hello, My Name is Craig.
Back to more of Hello, My Name is Craig on The Fan with your host, Craig Carton, and supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER.
Welcome back to Hello, My Name is Craig. Happy to have Paul from Brooklyn. Been in recovery for 41 years now, which is awesome. And, of course, Dan Trillaro. So, Paul, when you have that moment with the lady giving you the 10-cent tip, and now you're, kind of taking ownership of your life and you want to change your life, and your wife is now figuring out that you've been living this lie with her, was it easy for you the next day to just go to a GA meeting or talk to a friend, a family member, a priest, a father, whomever it might be? Or was it difficult for you to actually take those early steps in getting help?
That's an interesting point, because if it weren't for the fact that there wasn't a bookmaker that would give me action or a loan shark that would give me money with which to get the action, I would have been asking for help later on.
Got it.
Not only was my heart broken, the realization of the destruction that I had created, but it was really the fact that I could not get any more money to which to gamble.
God, so you were forced into recovery because you were tapped out and, your name was no good on the street. No one was going to lend you any money. Friends mm-hmm. were done giving you money. And now you have a choice, right? And the choice is run away from the problem. Some people do that. Or mm-hmm. just say, you know what? I got a problem. I got to own it and take the very long steps in getting back to who I really am as a person.
Yes. And that slowly but surely I was... I say all the time that no one ever comes down to or seeks recovery through their own volition. It's something forces us to end up walking down the steps to a meeting or walking up the steps to a meeting and face the problem.
Dan, that couldn't be. That is one of the most factual statements anyone has ever said on this show. We don't. It's a funny line. I was just listening to a Jelly Roll song when he's talking about going to his first AA meeting. And he goes, nobody ever walks into those rooms, whether it's drugs, alcohol, or gambling. Nobody walks into a room and says, hello, my name is blank, on a winning streak.
Right. Yeah, 100% right. 100% right. Yeah. And what's fascinating is, Paul, you said something that's interesting, because you didn't have access to credit or bookies or ways to make bets, it's like it kind of forces us in. And that's what people don't understand. They think gambling addiction is a money problem. Right. Mm, and so young people today will say, I come across a lot of young people that say, I stopped gambling. I'm done. I'm going to give this up. It's only because they have no more money. They haven't changed the the emotional aspect, the character stuff, right? And that's where money problems are the result of someone's gambling addiction, but it's more of an emotional issue, right?
Absolutely. And and it's a statement that I make quite a bit. When I see people come down and when they speak, they'll speak about the marital issues, or perhaps they put on too much weight, or they lost a job or whatever. And I say to them, well, you didn't come down to these rooms because you're overweight, and you didn't come down here because your marriage was on the rocks, and you didn't come down here because you're losing your job, and you didn't come down here because the law is after you. We come down because of gambling that causes a bad marriage, that causes me to lose a job, causes me to lose my family.
Yeah, you're so right. I'm trying to, the world has changed so much in your lifetime, and sports have changed so much. Like, mid-1950s, New York, we're about to lose the Dodgers to L.A. The Yankees, of course, are the greatest franchise on the earth. Giants football is awesome. And we go, kind of this idyllic, time of in this country's history. And for you, it was the exact opposite. It's your most painful time.
Absolutely. I don't remember, of course I do, but I don't have any memories of my teenage years and even my years in college, because my entire life was consumed by the action, by the excitement of the bet.
How long did it take you to not miss gambling?
Well, as someone once told me, I miss gambling an awful lot. And as I said before, the only thing worse than gambling was not gambling.
Right.
But I had no choice. I had no choice because of everything was closed to me. But then slowly but surely, I came to understand that that gambling for Paulie was a disease that I did not choose. So I would no more want to be referred to as Paulie the Gambler as I would Paulie who has stage 4 cancer. So why would I want to walk around being labeled with that? Once I understood that, then I started to make the program, because I really didn't want to stay in the program.
Sure.
I thought maybe that they would give me a little bit of salvation somewhere, somehow, but I'm kind of glad that it didn't.
Dan brought up something I talk about a lot, all the mental space that we take up with gambling and worrying about it and thinking about it and processing it. Where am I getting money from, and when am I going to go, and what lies am I going to tell, and all that stuff. And I wonder for you, what did you replace that void with? Once you were legitimately committed to not gambling anymore and you started getting healthier from a mental and emotional standpoint, what did you fill all that mental space with?
Well, the beginning, I had to support my family. So I had to devote a lot of time to work so that I could feed my family. That was number one. And then I decided after a while that I had to give back. We always say you cannot keep it unless you give it away. So I started to get involved in a program until after 30 years or so, I turned around and I screwed it up in a different way. But I had to keep myself busy.
Right. The downtime was a killer for you.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the killer for, when you have that freedom, all of a sudden your mind starts to wonder, and you say, what the heck am I going to do with this free time?
And before I let you go, and I really do appreciate your time, for a young guy out there now that's really at stage one, they're probably still gambling, and they're not quite sure how to stop. They're not quite sure how they could possibly dream or imagine a life without gambling, and they're in it. And the walls are caving in, and financial problems or relationship problems. What do you say to that young guy who's at step one of this? They know they've got a problem, but they're not committed just yet to walk into a room and get some help. What do you say to them?
Well, I always say to them that you are not responsible for the disease. You're responsible for your recovery. So you must take advantage, and don't ask, just accept the fact of the disease that you are powerless and your life is never, ever going to get better through gambling. So I had to, and I tell people, you have to surrender. You have to admit the fact that you are powerless. But you also have to accept the fact that your life will get better if you just stop one day at a time And my line is always the same. If you didn't bet today and I didn't bet today, my 41 years mean doodly squat. It means nothing. We are even for the day.
Well said. I can't thank you enough for coming on. Really appreciate you sharing your story. And I hope to get to meet you one day and give you a big hug because you deserve it. And I'm really proud of you.
Well, thank you very much.
Take care. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.
We're getting close to Thanksgiving, and I don't want to be cliche about this, you know, but when you get to the stage you've gotten to in recovery, the stage I've gotten to in recovery, it is not, you know, hyperbole to look back and recognize how much we have to be thankful for in our lives.
Absolutely. I mean, Craig, I remember Thanksgivings of the past. It was all about the football games and not about the family, not about anything else. And it's about just not being present. You know, I think that's the biggest thing I've realized. And you and I talk, you know, each year right around Thanksgiving. And, you know, the one thing I always know now is, like, being able to be present. And it doesn't mean that things will always go smoothly or easily. It doesn't mean that I don't have recollections of betting on the games or watching. You know, it just means that being able to manage life without having to gamble, being able to spend time with family, especially family that's stuck by your side, seeing kids grow up and just be there to see that, it just hits differently. It really does. It hits differently as recovery just continues along. How about for you?
Yeah, it's all that, you know, the somewhat obvious stuff, family, kids, job, friends. Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday. One of the more powerful things for me is, and I know you've experienced this as well, is Thanksgiving 2019. I waited in line for a bologna sandwich for dinner. It's prison is what I'm alluding to.
Yep.
And for someone who loves Thanksgiving in every aspect of it and gets up, you know, at 4 a.m. to start, you know, prepping, you know, the turkey or whatever it might be, I go back to that day because that was the worst Thanksgiving I ever had. And as I tried to rebuild my life and live my life in a more honorable manner and knowing that I'm going to be blessed as you are, that I'll be surrounded by family and friends in a couple Thursdays, I do take myself back to that one.
I think about being in the D pod, lower bunk, bed 20, waking up on Thanksgiving morning, watching the parade, you know, all the things I would do at home, but then having to go in the yard. I went for a 10-mile run on Thanksgiving in prison, in my boots, 60 laps around the yard, 6 laps was a mile, and then waiting in line and getting that chicken dinner. And just, that was the most miserable and worst Thanksgiving, you know, because I wasn't gambling too. I mean, Craig, there were other Thanksgivings that were probably bad, but I was in such action, I couldn't see it at the time. But I don't want to ever lose that. I don't want to forget that, where I was on that Thanksgiving in prison either. I agree with you.
Well done. We will do a show next week. That'll be our last one until after Thanksgiving. So more on that and these stories for sure next week. Thanks to Paul very much. Dan, have yourself a great weekend as always. And we appreciate everybody listening to Hello, My Name is Craig. You've got Joe Beningo up next.